mentored by some of the best minds in entrepreneurship in the world, then you're listening to the right podcast, Ditch Digger CEO. We're going to be interviewing CEOs and founders who will be telling their amazing rags-to-riches stories. These entrepreneurs who dominate the industries they serve will be sharing the secrets to their success. We'll be talking to millionaires and billionaires, many who started with nothing. You're going to be mentored with golden nuggets of shared experiences from my guest, whose time is worth thousands and even tens of thousands of dollars per hour. I started in the paving business right out of high school, and with no college education, mentorship has been my education of choice. I started over 25 companies in the last 20 years, have generated over $1.5 billion in revenues. My guarantee is this. If you listen to Ditch Digger CEO and you want to be more successful, you will become more successful. The secrets of my success and for many of the world's greatest business leaders will be revealed. Let Ditch Digger CEO mentor you.
Today on Ditch Digger CEO, we've got Tom Ryan, founder and CEO of ICR, Integrated Corporate Relations. So Tom's going to tell you all about what leadership's like in his business, consulting business, and what it's like to be a leader in a company he started. We'll talk a little bit about YPO maybe, because we're both members of that, and just what makes us what amps us up every day of our life. So Tom Ryan, welcome to Ditch Digger CEO. Thanks for being here today.
Yeah, Gary, thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Tom, you know what? I know we have a few things in common, and I'd love to kind of, you can talk about a little of that, but then just talk about, you know, what it's like in your business, what it was like to build what you built, because this podcast is in front of a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs, right? People that were where you and I were at, you know, 30 years ago, 20, 30, 40 years ago, whatever, right? And trying to figure out their way. Yeah. And I think we learn the most by sharing experiences.
For sure.
I think your experiences are amazing, and just like to, you know, tell your story from the beginning. What it was like.
Yeah,
I
grew up in Norwalk, Connecticut, which is about an hour north of New York City. My dad was an accountant. My mom emigrated from Sweden and came here in her 20s, and I'm an only child. The good news is I've learned how to share over the years, so that's good. But you know, look, as I was growing up, I went to not a boarding school, but I went to a day prep school. Was surrounded by a lot of guys who I think were ambitious, you know, and learned a lot from my friends. I went to College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, for undergrad. And I just always had a sense that, wanted to like accomplish something. I always tell people you don't have to know where you're going as long as you're on your way. And, always tried to invest in learning and getting new experiences and excelling when possible. Wasn't like the greatest student, but I'm a good people person, and that counts for a lot in life. When I was a kid, my dad was an accountant at a big company, and he made the decision when I was 16 to leave on his own and start his own business. And he was just a sole proprietor, and he would do people's tax returns and do their books and things like that for just local businesses in our town. And, he was always home. He was always around for like Little League sports and things like that. And as I got through college, I went down, I had a short stint on Wall Street for 3 years. I was a government bond salesman working down in the financial district. I decided to go back to business school. I went to Vanderbilt to get my MBA. I always had in the back of my mind that I would kind of have my own business someday, because if for nothing else, I saw how much flexibility it gave my dad to spend time with his family. And so while I was at Vanderbilt Business School, I did a project, second semester senior year, we had to do a project in the local community. And there was a guy down there. He was an entrepreneur on the outskirts of Nashville. He was assembling and selling video poker machines into the state of South Carolina, desktop, like bar top poker machines. And at the time, the casino business was exploding across the country. And in South Carolina, it was a gray area law. You could pay out, like if you hit a straight flush, the bartender could pay out, even though gambling technically wasn't legal. The long and the short of it is this guy was an amazing entrepreneur. I got out of business school at during a recession. I went to work for him. 20 years later, he sold the company for $1.3 billion. He's one of the richest men in Tennessee now, but just an incredible entrepreneur. Just to watch the way he operated, that was just another data point for me. And then after business school, I was a sell-side research analyst, writing the buy, hold, sell research reports for people who are interested in stocks. My industry was the casino industry. Met all kinds of characters, a few gangsters, Steve Wynn, Donald Trump, all the guys that built Vegas originally and then in the 90s. And after a while, I decided, hey, you know, I've accumulated a lot of knowledge about companies, about how Wall Street operates. And I thought, hey, you know, maybe it's time to take a shot and start something on my own.
So that was you did that work for other people up until what year is this then?
1998.
And then at the age of, what were you, probably 35, 40?
34, yeah.
34.
I had part of my job, I worked for Bankers Trust, and that became BT Alex Brown through an acquisition, and then ultimately Deutsche Bank. What I learned there is how an investment bank operates. And I was put into a lot of situations as an expert where I'd be in the C-suite, you know, in front of a very seasoned CEO or board asking me my opinion on the financial markets or their stock or all those things. And I learned from some really savvy people how to handle yourself in meetings with people with big egos and how to navigate situations like that. And so at a relatively young age, I was very good at kind of selling people or having a presence, whatever you want to call it, in the room where it mattered under pressure when things are the highest stakes. And part of my job as an analyst, companies would come in New York and they'd lay out their PowerPoint presentation and, you know, they'd want me to write a positive research report, or they'd want me to get on board with an investment banking transaction. Maybe they're doing an IPO or a secondary offering, raising a lot of money. That would have to kind of check through me. And typically they would have somebody sitting next to the CEO and the CFO advising them on how to talk to me. And it was somebody with a PR background who didn't understand a P&L or a balance sheet, or didn't understand how the financial markets worked or what created or destroyed value in the market by what you said and how you acted. And I thought I should be the guy advising the CEO on how to talk to me, because I've been a Wall Street Journal ranked analyst for 7 years. And so the beginning of ICR was a bunch of former portfolio managers and analysts kind of teaching companies investor communications, public companies, on your quarterly earnings calls. What do you say? How do you manage expectations? How do you navigate the public markets? And, you know, to this day, when you listen to a quarterly earnings call, from a management team, we will typically be behind the scenes writing almost everything the CEO says preparing them for all the Q&A after the fact during questions. And we do a lot of other things, but that's really where it started.
So 1998, 34 years old, you had confidence that you could build a business on your own because you saw the problem that you can solve, right?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
That's cool.
Yeah, at that time, only big PR firms were doing it, and it was a small subsegment of what they did. And so they kind of faked that they did it. And, you know, they understood the capital markets from the outside looking in versus, you know, somebody like me and my partners. You know, we were in it firsthand. Like, we knew exactly what companies needed to say to maintain credibility, which is the key in any business. You know, lay something out, do what you say, build credibility. It puts you in a position to raise capital, to bring in new investors. That's the whole key to being a public company for sure.
Yeah, whether it's through a little downturn or big upswings, whatever, right? Building credibility the whole way through, good times and bad times.
Yeah.
People, you know, to build trust, right?
Yeah. And you know, as a public company, the law says you've got to release your financial statements every quarter. The law doesn't require you to have a conference call and explain them, but almost every company does because it's important to get that context. And no matter what the conditions are, recession, boom, you know, every company goes sideways, every company misses earnings, every company has problems, and investors know that. But as the leadership of a public company, you have to step up, be transparent, and, you know, own what's happening in the company. And I think ultimately, if you're, you know, if you're forthright and straightforward and not trying to spin things, because people who own stocks like Fidelity and T. Rowe and these portfolio managers are among the smartest people around. They can see through the BS. And what they just want is to clearly understand what's happening. And I think if you do that consistently, you get a higher multiple in the market, even if your results aren't that, you know, go sideways temporarily.
Sure, sure. Now, so you started out with how many, you and who else, when you first started this, when you knew you could serve this market?
Yeah, me and my best friend and two of my best friends, we all went to high school together. We all went our separate ways. One guy ended up being an attorney, John Flanagan, and my other partner, Chad Jacobs. He was my roommate for 4 years in college, played hockey. He was also an analyst, but in a different sector. And we were all kind of at that same crossroads where we thought, hey, you know, we can do this. It took like nothing to capitalize the business. It's not like, hey, let's go build a factory. You know, it's like all we need is three telephones and we're three computers and we're in business. So it took very little to capitalize it. And through our relationships, as you can imagine, I was tight with every public company in the casino space and the broader entertainment space, every private company that was about to go public. And I said, you know, get rid of these advisors who don't know what they're doing and, you know, come with us. You'll be our first clients. We'll kill for you. We'll work for any price. And, you know, that's exactly what we did. So it was really just the three of us to start. And, you know, fast forward, we have about 375 employees and a couple hundred million in revenue. And, you know, it's a real business. My biggest strength, I think, is kind of, you know, I want to say like, kind of having people buy into a vision a little bit. You know, I don't want to like overstate that, but you know, when you're kind of like, you know, three guys in a tiny space with no health benefits, you know, you gotta have people believe. And I think we had something very different. We had a very different service in the marketplace, one that had a real competitive advantage. And so, you know, one by one, we had a core, maybe five or six clients. And then, you know, we added people. You know, working as an analyst is a grind. It's a tough job. You know, you're on a plane constantly. You can do well financially, but there's certainly no balance in life. And we went to Wall Street and we found people like us who were a little burnt out on that lifestyle and gave them a very transparent compensation model where they could do really well if they built a book of business with us. And you know, ours is not like a software company where you come out with the software and it's like infinitely scalable with not a lot of people. This is like blocking and tackling, adding people. You know, it took 25 years to get to where we are. And, you know, but along the way, I feel like what we've built out is sector expertise. So we've got, you know, a whole team that works with real estate companies and construction, kind of the business that you're in. We have a whole technology group that works with 150 software companies. We have a healthcare practice that's huge. So it's a big diversified portfolio of clients, over 1,000, but in 25 different industries, including emerging industries like mobility, electric vehicles, electrification, things like that. So, you know, it took a long time to add people, but we're transparent about what we pay them, and they can do really well if they're successful here.
What percentages, you started out pretty much mostly all casino work, is that right?
No. That's actually, we started with a few clients in that area because that was my background. But over the last 25 years, we've added all different industries. And the casino business is really like consolidated. So there's just a few players in there now. In the 90s, when I first started, there was lots of different companies getting financed, but it all consolidated. You know, our biggest two sectors right now are probably healthcare and technology. But we do a lot in all kinds of sectors, and lots and lots of consumer companies like Beyond Meat and Darden and Shake Shack and Lululemon. And, you know, you walk down any main street in the U.S., everybody's our client.
That's cool. So started out a large percentage was casinos, now a very small percentage today, right?
Very, very small, very diversified. No one client is more than 2% of our revenue.
Wow.
So, you know, no client concentration, and diversified by industry. So, you know, we have a lot of clients in Asia that hire us to help them tell their story here, because maybe they're listed on NASDAQ, company like Tencent Music, where there's not only a time change, but there's a cultural difference, and they need a help communicating with investors in the media and other stakeholders here. So yeah, we have clients from all over the world, Israel, South America, everywhere.
And what percentage of your business is recurring?
About 75%. So it's like a really rock solid model. We go into, for example, we go into 2023 with you know, knowing 3/4 of our revenue, knock on wood, is in the bag unless something bad happens. And, you know, we've had 2 down years revenue-wise, year over year, in 25 years. So it's been kind of up and to the right the whole time. It's the investor communications piece is extremely sticky. Every 90 days, the company has to tell their story in a very high stakes situation. But then on top of that, we do business financial media consulting. We probably put more companies on CNBC than anybody in the world. If you watch CNBC, we do all kinds of what we call special situations, communications around mergers and acquisitions, around, you know, bankruptcy, management change, anything that goes bump in the night that, you know, is in a, you know, foodborne illness, product recalls. You can imagine there's a strategy internally at a company for taking care of that. Companies spend a lot of time figuring out how they're going to communicate it. A, if you're a public company, to investors, the media is going to be knocking on your door. What do you say to employees? What do you say to your business partners? How do you choreograph all that? That's really the heart of what we do.
Wow, that's really, really interesting stuff. So when you look at your 200 million revenues spread over 500 customers, or how many customers?
Over 1,000. Yeah. Wow. And and there's another thing that we do that I failed to mention, but we're very involved in advising around capital raises, around IPOs. We probably work on more IPOs and SPACs, which is, you know, a recent trend, than almost any agency. And we don't raise capital for companies, but we sit on their side of the table, given our background as banks. Let's say you had a company that was going public, investment bank XYZ comes to you, says, hey, we're going to help you take your company public. And you feel like you're the client, but you're actually not the client. The people buying the shares, like Fidelity and T. Rowe and all the big institutions, that's the investment bank's client. We sit on your side of the table and help you. It help really demystify that whole transaction for you, and help you negotiate the economics with the banks and the final investor list and dealing with all that. So
SPACs were pretty popular. Are they still popular? I mean, they're pretty popular a couple of years ago. And
yeah,
I mean, there's a couple of stories that maybe, you know, made them a little less popular.
But yeah. They kind of, yeah, that's a nice way to put it. You know, the structure itself, it's a special purpose acquisition company. And, you know, under ideal circumstances, you get a bunch of smart people that raise a pool of capital, a couple hundred million, and they go look for a target. And they've got 2 years to find an acquisition. And basically, they merge with that private company and they're instantly public. There was a huge craze in 2021. Everybody was going public, like Shaquille O'Neal and A-Rod, and all these celebrities got involved, which is like, you know, the beginning of the end, you know, when you start seeing stuff like that. But the structure still has a lot of merit, and it'll go back to a normalized pace of deals. There are groups that have done a lot of successful SPACs who have a great track record in making people money. But for when you think about it, the IPO window has been closed for the last year. Companies have not been able to get public. They still need to raise money. This is an alternative to that. And as an entrepreneur, let's say you have a company, you can negotiate your price in a SPAC. The SPAC can come to you and you could say, look, I want X for the company. And that's what you'll get. Versus going out with an investment bank, and they'll give you a range of what they think, you know, your company's worth. And then the deal comes together, and you see this all the time on TV. The first day the stock shoots up 20 points and you're thinking, geez, did I just leave 20 points on the table? You can, with a SPAC, you can negotiate your own price. So I think it's going to be in the, you know, in the mix with transactions and ways that companies go public, but it won't be the craze it was in 2021.
So Joey and I and a team of people here are going to be rolling up companies in my space. And we've got five companies that are paving companies across the country right now. And I'm going to roll up 30 more in the next 7 years.
Yeah.
I think I could do it with my own money maybe, but yep. I may raise a small tech capital, I'm not sure. But you know, I have a son-in-law he's a tax attorney. And he's saying, man, you could do this in a SPAC. If you're going to be this aggressive, you should consider a SPAC. Now, I'm not sure, you know, if it makes sense or not, but
I think, you know, yeah. Sorry to interrupt you, Gary. I think that, I think you got to have a substantial company underneath you to do that. One that's worthy of being a public company. You know, I think what we saw in 2021 was even some pre-revenue companies like going public that were like launching rockets into space. And, you know, like maybe that capital helped them build an infrastructure. And look, the buyers of those shares knew what they were getting into. But I think if you can do some of that with your own money and get it to a certain scale,
right.
The larger you get, the more optionality you'll have where you'll be able to say, hey, door number one, door number two, door number three, like maybe I'll go public. Maybe I'll do it through a SPAC. Like you'll have a lot more optionality and
yeah,
things can be messy. It can be messy to run a business as a public company with that spotlight on you. So you want to make sure you've got great visibility, you know, a great economic model and approach to those acquisitions and like kind of plug and play. You know, show that you can do it 10, 15 times, and then you're off to the races.
Yeah. So that might be what we do. In the last 4 years, we greenfield in two markets in Maryland near DC and Dallas, Texas. And we show that we can grow these markets greenfielding.
Yeah.
It's a nice little, you know, 20 million plus markets in a couple of years. And
awesome.
We think we can do that in 30 markets. And so whether we, you know, to greenfield takes a lot more time, energy, and all that. To buy a small, very small company, like you know, $10 million company making $1 million a year, to buy 30 of those, we're pretty confident we get those companies to 30 to 50 million within 5 years because of some differentiators we have in our marketplace. So I have to figure out, you know, right now we're just under 200 million in our paving businesses. We think we get to a billion within 7 years. You know,
yeah.
So what are numbers that make sense? I don't know, right?
Yeah, I think that the one thing that is important to always note in those situations is when you start getting advice from people, who's the client? Like, are you the client? And so, you know, I think when we talk to companies, they're our client. They pay us to give them advice. We don't care what a company does. We want the best outcome for them. And there are a lot of advisors like that, not just us. Mm-hmm. But you know, the trick in life, as you know, is, and I study CEOs. I've been in the room with CEOs under pressure for 30 years. And the best, it takes an ego to get to that position. Once you're at that position, you got to figure out a way to surround yourself with the best people and the best opinions. And your superpower is to be able to pick the best opinion in the room and go with it.
So that's interesting. Yeah. It takes an ego to get there.
Yeah.
But then the best leaders probably
have no ego.
Probably have no ego, right?
Well, I mean, they have an ego, but when it comes to big decisions,
right,
they don't think they know everything because no one can know everything.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're right. I see that for sure. Okay. So when you think about that, right? Leadership and leadership values, you see that are overwhelmingly create success. And then leadership that sometimes create, you know, it turns into failure, right?
Yeah.
Give us some examples of what you believe create, you know, great leadership, and maybe some that you know we can share experiences of.
I think about it all the time. Like, if you're an entrepreneur, I think you know, optimism goes a long way. It sounds so simple, but you're going to have a checklist of 10 problems every day that come your way, and that can really get you down. You know, if you kind of are energized and optimistic, that flows through your entire team. And there's like a real can-do attitude versus, you know, getting depressed and like, oh my God, this is going wrong again, because building a company is one step forward, two steps back. Always, you know, and you gotta have the optimism isn't to get through it. You gotta be able to sell a vision, build a culture. When we first started, I was with my two best friends, and you know, people's wives would come and help out, and you know, every new person we had, we'd say, you know, welcome to the family. And a lot of companies say that, like, oh, the company XYZ family. And you know, I started not to like that term because you're stuck with your family, right? Like, Uncle Joe comes to Thanksgiving and drinks too much and talks politics, and you got to invite him back every year. When you get to a certain size, I think you're a professional sports team. You got to care about each other, have chemistry, but you got to have the best people in the best slots, not like a little league team where everybody makes the team. Like, professional sports team where you're there to win every day and put forth a great effort, but you still have to have that chemistry and care about each other to win the championship.
I like that. Yeah. So in small business, you kind of start like a family, and I agree. It's kind of, you know, small business, you're together all the time. It's like a small family.
Yeah.
And as you grow up to the size of your business and ours and others, you know, yeah, you want that culture, like, you know, you care about each other, but you're professionals now, and you're like a sports even, you know, you work hard and do a great job and continue to progress, and this family you'll be part of this team, right?
Yeah.
But if the team changes, the team, you know, is you know, reaches the World Series, you know, you're gonna have to be an all-star to probably play on this team, right?
Yeah, particularly if you take outside capital, you know, it becomes a very professional thing. You know, we've done that, and it's been a great experience. But you know, it is a higher stakes situation where, you know, you're really running a professional organization. So yeah, at some point that analogy changes, but there's no question the team has to be close, care about each other. That's a, you know, for a service business, that's been a challenge in COVID with COVID. You know, people working remotely. We've been remote for 3 years. Still, we're still remote. people can come in if they want, but a lot of people moved during COVID. Like, how do we deal with employee engagement and making sure everybody knows each other and they're on the same team? It's a challenge.
Absolutely. Well, are you seeing right now the money, the cash in private equities is lessened by 50%, 60% in the last year? What are you seeing?
I think private equity still has a lot of capital. You know, like I've been around long enough, and you probably have been too, to have lived through 2008, 2009. You know, when COVID hit, I'm like, this sucks, but it's nothing compared to 2009. 2009 was a credit crisis. There was no money on the sidelines to recapitalize businesses. You know, if someone went under during COVID, is certainly a tragedy and a bad thing, but there was money on the sidelines to recap that business. So I think private equity still has tons of capital sloshing around. I think they're would probably question a lot of wind at their back for the last 10 years. I think right now, as they put capital to work, they have to be very picky. They have to have the best, find the best companies with the most resilient business models. And it's a plus if they can see how a business lived through 2008, 2009, so they can make a judgment if there's a recession coming and how that might impact their returns. So I think it's just a little, and then, you know, geez, if the whole, their whole business model is putting, you know, a certain amount of equity down and borrowing the rest, and the interest rates have been at zero. So now they have to kind of recalibrate their models, because maybe the companies they're buying might be a little more wobbly in a recession, and their cost of debt is way higher. So they have to be a little bit more precise to generate the returns that they want to generate.
Sure. When you look at, you know, growing within a PE, let's say a company, you know, it gets to half a billion, or it gets to a certain point where they could, you know, potentially move to being a public company or staying private. Where do you see the advantages in this economy compared to 2 years ago in either or?
Yeah. I think for a certain number of years after the financial crisis, it was really in vogue, particularly for tech companies, to stay private for longer. And, you know, it's just like, this is just my own opinion on all that. I think companies like Uber, let's take Uber, for example, they stayed public until they were really big, and their whole mandate was grow revenue at any cost, right? So they were unprofitable. The WeWork guy was really the poster child for that, like tons of revenue. You can juice revenue as long as you want if you have capital behind you, even if you have no business model underneath you. And so I think what was happening is they were staying longer, and they were, you know, in the subsequent rounds of financing, people were taking money off the table, particularly insiders. And then they kind of said, okay, well, this has gotten to a certain size, we're going to kick it out to the public markets. And I think Uber went public at like 45, and the stock has never gone higher than that. And it's been like 5 years. So, you know, and then they had to go back and kind of re-engineer the company to get to profitability. Maybe had they grown revenue slower, but in a profitable way, they could have been public earlier. So that didn't really answer your question, but I do think, listen, right now, companies still need capital. The IPO window has been closed for a year. What's happening in every boardroom across America right now is, we need capital. We remember valuations and what they were in 2021, and we want that, but we're not going to get it. So I think we're going to have to either go public or raise capital at a much lower valuation, and then kind of take that money and increase the value of the company. And that's the way it always goes in every cycle.
Cool. So, who are your biggest competitors? Or, you know, what side are you competing with? Fortune 500 companies that do what you do, or anybody out there that's that big?
We compete with any PR agency, you know, because we do PR, we do corporate PR. Within that umbrella, You know, we're doing investor communications and business financial media and crisis communications, things like that. So really any PR firm from mom and pop, you know, to public companies like WPP, which is a publicly traded conglomerate of ad agencies and PR firms. So it just depends in what area we're helping a company. That will depend like who we compete with, but there's thousands of competitors out there. I think we've done really well because we're just very different. We're a bunch of Wall Street guys running a PR firm. So we can tie the efforts of communication to a business goal and the business goal to valuation. Sure. Most PR firms can't get in the room with a CEO and talk about how what they're going to do is going to help protect your valuation or maximize the value of your equity.
So are the conversations similar or the, let's say the stories told or the communications similar when you're representing private companies to public companies, private companies where, you know, they need to, you know, be honest and thorough to their investors. They need to potentially raise money in the future, right? They're going to have ups and downs, just like a public company. Do you guys have as much communication or as much relationships with private companies, you know, doing the kind of same thing?
Yeah. We do different things for private companies. So private companies, we could work for any private company. We tend to gravitate towards private companies that are backed professionally with professional capital, like PE backed companies, because they're tracking to something. They're either tracking to an IPO, tracking to a sale. So what we do for those companies is we help them elevate their story, right? Every company wants the spotlight. What I found is private equity professionals see PR as a line item to cut. And the reality is, I'll just give you an example. We had a client who was in the business of training bomb sniffing dogs. And so things that go bad in the world, you know, you go to an airport and there are dogs around and you never really think like, how do those dogs get trained? Who owns the dogs? All that stuff. So there are companies that train those dogs. And you know, if something bad happens, the Wall Street Journal will reach out to one of those companies for like a quote. If something happens, God forbid, in an airport. And we got a call from one of the biggest companies in the industry that does that. And they were kind of exasperated because their competitor, that was a third of the size, was getting in the Wall Street Journal as a thought leader on, you know, terrorism and things like that. And, you know, what I said to the CEO is, I will guarantee you that that firm has a PR firm like ours helping them tell their story. Sure. And I said, look, if you're not out there every day in the press, putting some resources behind this, if you don't tell your story, somebody else is going to tell it and they're going to get it wrong and you're going to hate it. So, you know, every company has to be out there really relentlessly telling their story so that people understand exactly what they're doing, because a lot of opportunity comes your way with that kind of visibility.
That's cool. So the thing about a company our size, I think, you know, I'm probably maybe a little bigger than the average YPO company, but, you know, there's probably a normal YPO company or group of companies. We have 13 companies, you know, revenues will be 240 or 50 million revenues, it looks like, for this ending 2022. But five of them are focused on pavements, concrete and asphalt pavements. It's my original business. I started at 18 years old, 41 years ago, right? And the rest of them serve the same industry, big facilities owners across the country. So the newer companies are companies that we start, and then we try to figure out if we can incubate them and then grow them to a quality company that can serve in other markets across the country. Okay. Paving business, we can serve the whole country now, and eventually want to serve small markets as well as the biggest markets in the country there. And that's why we want to roll up and do what we're talking about. But think about a company like mine. Well, where would your benefits be to a company like mine?
Yeah.
Because truly, we don't do a lot of PR, and we probably could.
I mean, so if you want to roll up an industry, you want to get your, you want to be the exit of choice for every paving company in the United States. They may know about you. They may not. There may be others trying to roll this up. But what you want to do is get into the publications. I'm sure there's like associations or trade rags that people that people read. And a lot of times, like maybe you'll get called up to comment on something, but you really have no strategy, right? It's kind of a onesie twosie thing. Well, you'll comment here and there. There's such a thing as like creating a strategy to kind of get into the trades, but then to get the brand known at a corporate level in other places. Cause if someone was going to invest in you, what do? They go on the internet, they figure out, you know, who you are, everything that's been written about you. Wouldn't you want to have a whole library, for lack of a better term, of articles written on what you're trying to do, the success stories you've had? We have a client that's doing the exact same thing in the fish distribution system, in the fish distribution business in Chicago, Fortune Fish. They're rolling up distributors all over the country. And so you want to be out there telling your story. You want to have a firm also sitting out there that you have a relationship with. If there's some crisis, I think what we've all learned in the last 10 years is information, bad news in particular, is immediate. It goes to everyone. It could bring down your company's reputation in no time. Do you have a crisis plan, literally like off the shelf? Here are all the lawyers, here are all the contacts, here's the playbook, here's who we call, here's how we handle it. You know, like we do all the crisis work for a fast food chain, which I won't name. But, you know, like it's open 24 hours a day and like people get hammered and they go there at 1 a.m. and a lot of bad things happen, right? They have a crisis playbook. That may not happen in the paving industry, but someone could get hurt, God forbid, or like a lot of, you know, one of your employees could not behave appropriately. You know, just like a lot of bad things can happen. So you want to be able to play defense at the drop of a hat. You want to also play offense. You want to get out there and tell your story because you want to be the exit of choice. And you know what? Once you start getting to those entrepreneurs around the country who could sell, you want to be the person that they want to sell to. That also helps your corporate reputation because, you know, if you're going to raise capital, people are going to do due diligence and read what's been written about you. So you don't have to do it right away, but something to think about.
So you guys will put together a whole plan, work with the team to understand the goals, the expectations, and then kind of build plan in front that should be in front of the public, as well as in the resource for anybody when it comes to the industry you're serving.
Yeah, that's what we do. And then a win, a home run for us is you grow, you do great. We have a relationship for a long time. You go public through a SPAC or an IPO. We have a whole other team that comes in that helps you navigate through that transaction because most people have never done an IPO before. And then you're a public company and you have people like me who was an analyst in that space. We do a lot in construction and the supply chain. And someone who like, okay, well, now I've got all these shareholders and it's going to take up 30% of my time and I'm trying to run the business. How do we get organized as a public company? How do I not blow myself up, make a mistake? You know, so we can stay with the company for the whole life cycle.
What a cool business model, because I mean, it's all about relationships, right?
Yeah.
And you're building relationships in many cases, you know, in private companies that you know, maybe sell to somebody bigger, big PEs that see the value in your services, or go public where, you know, you could be such an intricate part of that team.
It's very gratifying. We worked with a company, Olo, O-L-O, and it stands for online ordering. If you order something on your phone, like at a restaurant, and you go pick it up, you're probably using their software. We did PR for them, like I'm describing. They didn't want to raise their visibility as a technology company. They wanted to reach restaurant owners. So we put together a plan to reach restaurant chains and owners. And we did PR for them for 6 years. They went public, over multi-billion dollar market cap. And we do an entirely different suite of services for them now as a public company.
That's cool. That's awesome. Yeah. What a great story. Yeah. No, I'd love to talk to you more about that offline, because I think we have some opportunity. Sure. We can use some help in, for sure. And a couple of our business models. We have a technology company that is growing 100% or 100 to 200% value, enterprise value on an annual basis the last few years. And we don't see it slowing down much, but it's a technology that we're leading the world in. And it's basically just using great engineering, world-class engineering, applied through drones and artificial intelligence. And it's not only is it creating value in itself, the one business, but then our other businesses are benefiting from it too, because the relationships it earns with big facilities owners are relationships that we cherish in our paving business, roofing business, doors and docks, and all that things we do. So anyway, that's a whole other thing that's really it's a lot of fun. We've done nothing, like zero, when it comes to really gaining interest or getting in publications and talking about the big differentiators that it has.
Yeah, so, totally.
That's pretty cool. So awesome. So when you look at core values of your team, what do you guys have core values, a mission? Tell us a little bit about that before we close out. We got about 10 minutes left.
Yeah, at the heart of what we do is, we try and hire people with kind of a shared value system. I'm sure you have worked in situations with people who are absolutely brilliant, but toxic to a culture. I'd rather, hire someone who I know kind of shares the values of the team, and versus when you hire the wrong person, it costs you in so many ways, just not money, but time and cultural issues. For us, we're in the business of original thought and being different. The way companies have always done things isn't necessarily the right way. You've got to reinvent the way you talk about yourself going forward. We've got to do it with the highest level of integrity. As you can imagine, I'm the king of inside information. On a quarterly basis, I've got the financials of 1,000 companies. We have very strict insider information policies and how people can trade and personal accounts and things like that. So you got to have a really high degree of integrity, and you got to be really buttoned up to do what we do, because we're dealing with game-changing information that can move markets, and so you got to respect that. So I'm very proud to say we've never had any kind of issue in 25 years of running the company. Really good track record with that. And we always do the right thing by the client, even if it means turning money down. There are a lot of people who will take the money. And we've even had investment banks offer us money if we could steer a transaction towards them, which we run away from. So, I've turned down tons of money in my life, which would have been fun. But, you just can't do that if you want to have a long-term reputation.
I agree 100%. So, Joey's got a couple of questions for you. Joey Malavolti, fire away.
Yeah, great.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
How and why did you pivot from the Wall Street career to help companies communicate their stories?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier, I was kind of following companies from the outside looking in, where I would listen, I would get a press release or listen to a CEO talk about his performance, and then I'd write up what I thought in a research note. And I would say that's, they call that maintenance research. It's just not that fun, and when you're the 29th analyst writing your opinion on Disney, like, does it really matter? I felt that we had a competitive advantage to go inside a company based on my background and had it been done at that time, to go in as a Wall Street guy and get in there with the CEO and say, look, this is exactly what you have to say, and really helping the company put its best foot forward preserve its value. Presumably, you know, there's lots of stock options and shares throughout the organization. So you're really helping companies kind of preserve wealth and manage risk. And it's a lot more gratifying than what I was doing.
Absolutely. Anything else?
One last one. What did you want your legacy to be?
Yeah, I think what I'm most proud of, probably like most people in my position, is just, you know, been able to create, you know, my little tiny world. You know, I've been able to create lots of jobs for people, and, you know, they can pay their mortgages and live their lives and have a great, great life, hopefully. And so I think the legacy from here on in is just creating a platform where young kids can come out of college and excel and develop careers and, you know, just be fantastic at what they do. And if they work at ICR for a number of years, they'll be smarter than they would be working at any other agency in the world, because we're just so different. They'll learn a lot about the capital markets, what it takes to create value and manage risk as a public company and a private company. So it's really about empowering people and seeing them do great at this point, and just creating a unique agency that we can help all kinds of companies. It's fun.
Awesome. Awesome. And we like to finish up with Chris. Chris, our producer, kind of chimes in on a few of the lessons or success that he picks up. You know, what he believes could be the laws of success.
Yeah, there were a ton. You really know your stuff, Tom. if you want to go from 3 to 375 employees, get people to buy into the vision. Investor communication is extremely sticky. It takes an ego to get in that position of a successful business owner. And then it's your responsibility to surround yourself with the best minds. And then your superpower becomes to pick the best opinion in the room. I thought that was just incredible.
It's true.
If you don't tell your story, someone else is going to tell it and they'll get it wrong.
And you won't like it.
To roll up an entire industry, become the exit choice of every business in the industry. I loved your have a crisis plan ready at any time. I feel like not enough businesses.
No, people blow that off until it's too late, and it can cost you your job.
Yeah.
I see it all the time. I see CEOs with big egos and they think they know everything. And I walk out of the room, these public company CEOs, and I'm like, you know what? You're going to lose your job and you don't even know it. And you know, I've just been doing this for 30 years and ego is the biggest killer as a public company. So, you know, companies have to be prepared, and they don't like to spend money on things that they don't think they'll get a return on immediately. But it's a rounding error in the grand scheme of things, and you got to do it to protect your company.
100%. Pride and complacency kill so many good things, right?
For sure.
And that's a lesson I took out of this that I have to be reminded that always every day. Some of the best leaders in the world have been great for long periods of time because they stayed away from those two things, right?
Yep.
And you know what, Tom, you've been awesome. I really appreciate your time and lessons that you've given our listeners and myself. And I appreciate your leadership and what you do to create great companies.
Yeah, cool.
Thanks for being on Ditch Digger CEO today. And stay safe. Have a great day.
Likewise, it's been a lot of fun.
Tom, where can people find out more about you real quick, just before you?
Yeah, well, our website for my company is www.icrinc.com. And I have a podcast called Welcome to the Arena. Done about 60 episodes, and it's everybody in the ecosystem that helps companies create value. Lawyers, investment bankers, private equity, CEOs, CFOs, IP attorneys. It's been pretty well received. So it'd be great if your listeners followed that podcast. So welcome to the arena.
If you enjoy this show, please share with anyone else you think will find value here. And please go to our website, ditchdiggerceo.com, for show notes, links, video clips, and more nuggets of entrepreneurial wisdom. Don't forget to follow me on social media at Ditch Digger CEO. Cans, paper routes, mowing lawns, cans.